Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of my Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion on the Nagara Sutta, recorded at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on August 28, 2018. In this sutta, the Buddha describes the process of his own awakening, and it includes many other important teachings such as dependent origination, the importance of the Four Noble Truths, and the timelessness of the Eightfold Path. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So the Nagara Sutta, I'm not going to read the whole introduction. I think the introduction is longer than the sutta itself. But just to touch on a few points, just to bring them into our awareness. The Buddha first addresses himself, and he repeatedly addressed himself in this manner throughout his teaching career, by saying, when I was an unawakened bodhisattva, and just to put a little clarity on what that means, or bodhisatta is the Pali spelling, sattva is the Sanskrit spelling. What the Buddha's referring to when he's saying, when I was an unawakened bodhisattva, is he's describing himself as a human being with great compassion for all other human beings. But as you can see here, he's lacking an understanding of Four Noble Truths, of the true nature of human suffering, and so he cannot be truly effective in helping others. Why? Because he doesn't know. He really doesn't know the nature of suffering. If you don't know something, you can't teach it. You can't help anybody else. If I ask somebody to teach me how to change the oil in my car and they don't know how to do it, as loving and compassionate as they might be, they're just going to get me confused, or they'll be honest and say, I don't know. The bodhisattva path is the predominant path that most modern Mahayana Buddhists take, and it's usually in the form of a vow, and that vow usually goes something like this, is I will delay my own awakening until all other sentient beings are awakened, or a variant on it is I will seek awakening, but not for myself, only for the good of others. And of course, if the Buddha had continued in that path, well, for one thing, we wouldn't be here tonight. There'd be no Buddha's teaching, because that's just a distraction from developing an understanding of my own ignorance of Four Noble Truths. It sounds like a very altruistic path. I actually went through the formal ceremony in a Tibetan tradition of taking my vows and taking the Bodhisattva vow. I later on rather quickly denounced it. When I realized what it was. And I'm not putting down the path, and I'm not putting down all the people to take that vow, but it's something that I had to realize was not what an awakened human being taught as preserved in a Sutta Pitaka. And I remember, I don't remember it very clearly, but I remember reading the Buddha's words, saying this, when I was an unawakened bodhisattva, and it really knocked me on my heels, because I consider myself a bodhisattva. It took me a while to understand what he really meant, that he's simply describing himself prior to his awakening, how he always referred to himself, as a human being with great compassion. That's wonderful. We can all look at historical references to well-intentioned people driven by great compassion that caused great harm for others, because they simply didn't understand what they were doing, and they didn't understand the nature of truly helping someone gain understanding. He touches on other things here. Dependent origination is part of the sutta. Reference to the three marks of existence. Obviously, reference to the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. In fact, it's very clear towards the end of the sutta why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path, and that it was the only path that he ever taught, and why that's so. Why he didn't teach anything else, because this is what he was interested in. Let me read the sutta. The Nagara Sutta. The Buddha was at Savatthi at Jita's Grove, Anatha Pandika's monastery. There he addressed those gathered. Friends, before my awakening, when I was only an unawakened bodhisattva, I came to the realization of the difficulties of the world. The world is born, it ages, it dies, it falls away, and it returns. The reference to the world is both direct. This is how planets come and go, and people that live on the planet. But it's also, when the Buddha's talking about the world, He's talking about the conditions of the world, and he's talking about people. Remember when the Buddha describes suffering, he describes it in very similar terms. Birth, sickness, aging, and death. And then if we are still stuck in our karmic wheel of ignorance, rebirth in a world of ignorance. And we know that we're not only talking about a future rebirth. Every moment that we're stuck in ignorance, we're giving birth to another moment stuck in ignorance. And that's really the important teaching on rebirth, getting a little bit off the subject. It falls away and returns, but there is no understanding of ending the stress and suffering of aging and death. In other words, we keep going through these cycles of physical aging and death and never realizing what the cause of that is, but also moment by moment giving birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. And it's almost like that movie Groundhog Day. We can't figure out, why does suffering keep coming up? And very often, it seems to come up in the same scenarios, even if it's not exactly the same. And we can kind of sense an underlying continuing cause for the stress and suffering in our own lives. It seems like we're caught in this wheel. The Buddha describes that. Then I had the thought. Anyway, sorry. When will the world understand the cessation of stress and suffering from aging and death? The Buddha, he's describing his thinking process. What's going on here? Why are we all so caught up in this competitiveness and aggressiveness and these confused ideas about who and what we are in relation to the world? When will we understand this? The Buddha said, then I had the thought, what is it that initiates aging and death? What is the requisite condition that aging and death are dependent on for arising? Now remember, the Buddha's talking in an absolute sense and a relative sense. The physical arising and passing away of worlds, the physical arising and passing away of human life, but the most importantly, the physical arising and passing away of the experience of ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And that's key. That's when you can see clearly how the Buddha goes from this macrocosmic view and then very quickly comes to a microcosmic view, understanding what's going on inside of him that is reflected in that macrocosmic view, that worldly view. This is such an important line, I'm going to make a point of it. From my appropriate mindfulness, it's such an important word. I use the word refined mindfulness when I'm describing mindfulness as it relates to the Dhamma. The Buddha's using that word to infer that there's also inappropriate mindfulness. The Buddha has now gone from, now remember, this is 6 years into his search for awakening. And so he understands the danger of inappropriate mindfulness, but he also is able to recognize appropriate mindfulness. Remember how we talk about it's as important to understand what's not here anymore in our path as it is to recognize what is here. That's the essence of understanding that we're becoming empty of ignorance, which is the soul Buddha's teachings on emptiness. From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From birth as the requisite condition comes aging and death. Think about the simplicity of that in the macrocosmic sense. If I'm so concerned about aging and death and the suffering that often entails, what causes it? Being born. That's a significant point. And the Buddha's not being silly and not trying to give us a riddle. What he's pointing out that if we find ourselves in a physical realm, that physical realm is prone to the three marks of existence, meaning of impermanence, a not self characteristic, a misunderstanding of what constitutes a self. Excuse me. And the resulting suffering that comes from a misunderstanding of the impermanence of our environment and the wrong views that we're holding of ourselves. Suffering follows from that. The First Noble Truth makes a statement, dukkha occurs. And then the rest of the Four Noble Truths describe that process of awakening, just as dependent origination does. So again, the macrocosmic view speaks to impermanence, doesn't it? We all know, and nobody wants to really think about it, I don't want to think about it too much, but physicists have proven, we know now that even this great planet that we live on and the universe that it's a part of is completely impermanent. One day it will blink out of existence, won't it? And it could be the next moment. Moo, the cow's chasing us all. And that macrocosmic view starts refining our mindfulness towards an understanding of impermanence that none of us, nobody walks around their life, and we shouldn't walk around our lives thinking that the planet might explode any minute. But it's an act of human maturity to at least understand it, that any moment could be our next. Nothing is guaranteed. And it's because we crave for continued experience and cling to those experiences that we create stress and suffering in our lives, rather than understanding that any moment could be the last. Why is that important? Because it puts our focus on what's most important, on awakening, rather than the next moment of, I can't stop thinking about the new car I'm getting tomorrow. Well, that's wonderful that I'm not getting a new car tomorrow, by the way. But if I was, and I was distracted by that, I can't stop thinking about that shiny new car, I just forgot about what's most important. Maybe I should put my 30 minutes on the cushion and put a little thought towards awakening, rather than losing the opportunity that's present in this moment. So that's the macrocosmic view of worlds arising and passing away. But then, as Bahia learned, the microcosmic view is that I'm in a body that is impermanent. No matter how much I don't want to think about it or face the fact, one day I'm going to be gone. And there's no prediction. Nobody knows what's afterwards. I mean, there's traditions that tell you where you might go, but nobody knows. Nobody's ever come back and said, I got the answer. I know where you're going. And as far as we should be concerned as Dhamma practitioners, the most important thing is to awaken in this life. Why? Because we're either going to be stuck in this cycle again and have to figure it out all over again, or we can end it now. We can awaken right now. And then we get to live the rest of our years, maybe the rest of our minutes, with a mind resting in equanimity. A mind that is fully present with life as life occurs without the need for it to be any different than it is. Isn't that marvelous? Isn't that really the greatest experience we could have in this lifetime? It's not getting a new car tomorrow. It's awakening right now. And we can all do it if I continue to keep this going. Then I had the thought, what initiates birth? What is a requisite condition that birth is dependent on for arising? From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From becoming as a requisite condition comes birth. And I won't get into dependent origination entirely tonight, but there's that section in dependent origination between, I think it's the sixth and seventh, or seventh and eighth, from craving and clinging, or craving and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming. Remember that in context. Dependent origination starts that stating, from ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrications and the rest of that process leading up to confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering is formed by that. So in that context, craving and maintaining, or craving and clinging, comes becoming. In the context, it's becoming further ignorant. But we also have the option in every moment of recognizing ignorance of Four Noble Truths, integrating the Eightfold Path, and becoming awakening. And that's truly the only choice we have in each moment. It's the potential that each moment has to either become further ignorant by, in our case, ignoring the Eightfold Path. If we're not, most people aren't lucky enough to have heard of it. Or keep our minds focused on the Dhamma and become awakening. Hence the title of the book, Becoming Buddha, Becoming Awakening. That's the most important underlying teaching of the Buddha. What are we going to become in the next moment? And again, it's not important. I shouldn't be concerned about what I'm going to become in the next life or even next week. What I should be concerned about, what I hope I'm concerned about, is becoming awakened. Is that clear? The idea of becoming and the choice that we have in each moment? Yes. Nobody's confused about that? From becoming as a requisite condition comes birth. Then I had the thought, what initiates name and form? The Pali is Namarupa. It simply means name and form. Name means I have identified with this form. I've given this form a name. This is me. And when that view is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, this is me, and I'm going to do everything I can to promote and defend this thing called me. Let me keep going. There's so much in the sutta, I could take two nights to teach it. I should?
No,
we're good? We're good for a two-night
time? Yeah, on retreat, you haven't taken that much.
Pardon me?
The first retreat that you covered the Nagara Sutta.
I did take it. It's been a long time.
2 seconds.
So, then I had the thought, what initiates name and form? Self-identification, self-referential views. What is the requisite condition that name and form is dependent on for arising? From my appropriate mindfulness, there's that line again, came a breakthrough of understanding. From consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form. Now the Buddha is not describing some grand cosmic consciousness. Remember the context. He's talking about consciousness being ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So let me read it again. From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths as a requisite condition comes name and form. From ignorance of Four Noble Truths comes self-referential or self-identifying views. This is me. And I don't mean, we can get too mystical and magical about, well, if this isn't me, what is it? It's a fixed view of self, insisting that this is me and this is all that I am, and my views constitute who I am when those views are rooted in ignorance. As we learn through the Eightfold Path, what a self, and from, if you read the chart, what constitutes a self is always in a process of becoming. And if that consciousness now is resting in a refined mindfulness, meaning it has integrated the Eightfold Path, then there's no stress or suffering. In this, a now body united with its mind, not a mind and body disunited or disassociated, which is really another essence of the Buddha's Dhamma. I'm fully present in this thing. There's no self-reference now to the form. I'm simply a mind united with a body in the constant process of becoming or living as an awakened human being. No identity. It's a little bit of a difficult concept, but do you understand where I'm going and what I'm talking about? It's one of the reasons why we've created these mythologies that the Buddha was teaching. There's no such thing as a self, and there's more than one modern Buddhist school that teaches when you awaken, poof, you just vanish. Well, I wouldn't want that anyway, but the example of the Buddha is a good example. He awakened and lived 45 more years teaching his Dhamma. From consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form. In other words, I have to have a thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths to have that self-identification with form. I'm skipping over my comments because I'm giving you most of them. Then I had the thought, what initiates consciousness? What is the requisite condition that consciousness is dependent on for arising? Remember, thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From name and form, from self-identification, as a requisite condition comes consciousness. Do you see the feedback loop now that the Buddha is stuck in and that we all get stuck in? We're identifying ourselves from a wrong point of view, and that wrong point of view continues to encourage and validate the thinking rooted in ignorance, the self-referential views. How are you going to get out of it? It's the essence of ignorance, isn't it? And so we create these very powerful and subtle strategies to continue to ignore our own ignorance. Yeah, let me keep going. From name and form as a requisite condition comes consciousness. Excuse me. Then I had the thought. This consciousness turns back at name and form and goes no further. The Buddha is describing himself understanding and recognizing that he's stuck in wrong views, and those views go no further. one of the ways that the Buddha would describe his life, and even life in the world when you're entangled in the world, as a confining space. He's defining it here, isn't it? When we're stuck in self-referential views, we've created our own confining space. We can't see past those views. And most everything we do to keep reaffirming those views, whether we realize it or not. And often, no matter how much stress and suffering we bring into our lives, we'll justify it on some level so we can continue those views. I'm one of the fortunate ones because I had a real identifiable active addiction. I'm only half joking. There's nothing like that to come out the other side and recognize being stuck in extreme self-referential views, because every drink and drug I ever took, I felt justified in doing it. Why? Because mostly because it made me feel good and it continued my views of the world. But we all develop different levels of compulsive thinking that keeps reaffirming views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Most of us don't have to go to the extreme that I did to recognize it, but there I am. And I just realized, I'm making a comment on addiction that could actually be seen as very hurtful. There's nothing useful about an addiction, even if you're lucky, as lucky as I am, that it didn't kill you and it puts you on the path to awakening. Most people die from addiction, like the kind that I had. So we don't want to chase after it, hoping that it'll lead us to enlightenment, because I came that close a few times. Frank, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I was just trying to let my mind go with this the teaching where the Buddha's mind was, where he's teaching this feedback loop. And I was just curious when he taught the Satipatthana Sutta, because on the second foundation of his teaching, he talks about feelings arising, mm-hmm. and then being mindful of the state of your mind, especially in the feeling part, the feeling mode, like not in the body, being in the mind, not in the body, return to the breath. His teaching on thoughts and how it could be discursive, and how we start judging thoughts, and then that leads to emotions, and it's like if that was where the feedback loop kind of gets caught up with, if you're not mindful of that third foundation.
Yes, thank you. That's great insight. And so the basic instruction on meditation there, on the four foundations of mindfulness, every time we recognize that we're being distracted by a feeling, or distracted by a thought, or a thought attached to a feeling, which is an emotion, and we recognize it, we're cutting that feedback loop in that moment. And in that moment, we're extricating ourselves from that feedback loop that we're caught up in. And even if it's just for a moment, it's the beginning of deepening concentration and supporting the refined mindfulness. Thank you for bringing it up. Now, is that clear what I just said? Mm-hmm. That is how incredibly practical Shamatha Vipassana meditation is, and why it's the only meditation the Buddha ever taught. Because it gets right to the heart of that matter, of being stuck in discursive thoughts, being stuck in the feedback loop. And that simple meditation method of recognizing when we're caught up in the feedback loop and coming back to our breath interrupts the entire process. And leads to, and you understanding what Frank just said, and hopefully what I just said, you can understand why the Buddha taught meditation, isn't it? Not just any meditation, this specific meditation. Because it's what he used to extricate himself from this feedback loop.
For where I'm right now with it, it's like, I think the instruction says, being able to hold the breath in mind for a few minutes, then you're able to see that thoughts and the feelings and kind of cut through the weeds of all that. And I know some days are harder, but I'm, for the most part, like I'm talking off the cushion.
Yeah.
I'm talking like in the world, like at work, and I can be mindful of the breath and thoughts coming up, but like in conversations with people, and I'm trying to be quicker with it, where I'm like being mindful of like the conversation, like observing it going on and my thoughts going and feelings that are coming up during conversations, and I'm non-reactive mind state and being, observing the quality of mind. it's just like a challenge.
Yeah, but it works though. It brings you back into the present moment. And in that way, it's a teaching on impermanence, even the impermanence of something arising. I'm recognizing stress or agitation. If I can come back into the breath, if I can unite my mind with my body, the stress tends to dissipate. Why? Because you're into the present moment, not in a past moment. And again, even if it was just a moment ago, you're still not there anymore. You're living back in reality. That's why I keep emphasizing the Buddha taught a profound way of uniting the mind and the body, because a mind that is agitated in any way, it doesn't have to be just being upset, it could be extreme elation over getting the new car tomorrow, you're out of your body. And if you're out of your body, you're out of your life. And stress will follow. Why? Because it makes sense, doesn't it? We're psychophysical beings. We need to have it all together if we're going to be all together. Thank you. Let me go back one sentence. Then I had the thought, this consciousness turns back at name and form and goes no further. It is to this extent that there is birth, aging, death, falling away, and returning. Isn't that remarkable? When we are stuck in that feedback loop that the Buddha is describing, it initiates suffering. It initiates the ongoing process of suffering. So the solution then is to get out of the feedback loop, isn't it? He doesn't leave us there. This is where ignorance is established, meaning from self-referential views. From self-referential views, name and form is the self-referential views, or name and form, is the requisite condition that brings consciousness, and from self-referential views, consciousness is a requisite condition that brings name and form. It's so discursive, it's hard to even follow that, but do you get it? We're just stuck in it. From self-referential views, rooted in views that are in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, we simply get stuck in this feedback loop. And it's the nature of ignorance to ignore anything that would challenge its own ignorance. That's one of the great revelations that the Buddha had, and what he considered for 2 weeks post his awakening. How can I teach this? How can I teach people that they are rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths when it's the nature of ignorance to ignore itself? You need an Eightfold Path. Then I had the thought, the sixth sense base, this is where it ties into what we're talking about recently on the series on restraint. Then I had the thought, let me just clarify something that might be confusing for you. We have five physical senses, and the sixth sense is our thinking, our ongoing consciousness. And that consciousness is interpreting the world through the contact with our five other senses, correct? And so in the most practical way, we practice restraint at the point of contact, where we come into contact with the world. And in another way of looking at it, and through the four foundations of mindfulness, where we come in contact with our own thoughts. So that when we're talking about the sixth sense base, that's what the Buddha is referring to here. And the teaching is to learn to practice restraint and not react or grasp or cling to something that's just coming in contact with our senses. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Good. I didn't want to leave you hanging. What's he talking about? Is it clear with everyone else?
Mm-hmm. Good.
The Buddha continues, then I had the thought, the sixth sense base is dependent on the condition of name and form. It is dependent on self-referential views. And this is the origination of the entire mass of suffering.
Can you say that again?
I was hoping somebody would ask. Then I had the thought, the sixth sense base is dependent on the condition of name and form. Now think about that. It's an awakened human being still has the six senses, but in the context of suffering arising, it is interpreting what's coming in contact with us that's rooted in ignorance that leads to the entire mass of suffering. Again, it's also reaffirming, maybe that's not the right word. The Buddha slowly does not, see, not even, that's not the right word. The Buddha's pointing out where liberation lies in ending ignorance of Four Noble Truths.
It's dependent on what condition this name and form is in?
No, thank you for the question. The six senses gives rise to consciousness rooted in ignorance from self-referential views, from name and form, from self-identity. If there's no self-identity, then what we're coming in contact with will cause no reaction and no furtherance of ignoring ignorance.
Who we are.
In other words, we're using what we are, but from a point of view that is rooted in ignorance of the way things really are. So then anything that happens can only reaffirm that, right? Unless we're taking a different view. We'll go from, again, this utter simplicity of the Buddha's teaching, it takes us from wrong view to profound right view. What is the Buddha describes right view from the point of view of an awakened human being as having a profound understanding of stress and suffering. And from that profound understanding of suffering, we no longer contribute to our own. And he describes the quality of a mind of an awakened, fully mature human being as calm. No big deal, huh? It's just a matter of developing and continuing and completing the Eightfold Path. Because then we stop interpreting the world and ourselves in relation to the world from a view rooted in ignorance. And we see the world. Excuse me, I didn't eat dinner tonight. I had a busy day. It gives me agita, as they used to say. We simply see the world clearly. And when we see the world clearly from the wisdom of an awakened human being, why would we react? And it doesn't mean we become a lump. In fact, we become more mindfully engaged as we become awakened bodhisattvas with the knowledge of a human being rather than being an unawakened bodhisattva, as the Buddha described himself before going through this process. And so we're simply more, you hear me say it often, the most loving thing I can, if I'm concerned about the people around me and the world at large, the most loving thing I can do is to awaken, because then I can be an example and I can stop contributing in any way possible that I might not even be aware of it, I can stop contributing to any suffering in the world. It's the essence of awakening, isn't it? And it's the essence of establishing a calm and peaceful mind. Let me continue, we're not going to get through this tonight. The sixth sense base, then I had the thought, the sixth sense base is dependent on the condition of name and form, dependent on self-referential views, and this is the origination of the entire mass of suffering. Did I review it enough for you?
Say again? Yes.
You asked me to read it again.
Yes.
Okay. The Buddha continues. Now he's coming out of this haze, this veil of ignorance that he's lived. You know, he's 36 years old now. He's done what's necessary to awaken, and he's starting to understand. Vision arose, understanding arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illuminating insight. Now, of course, that insight is to the three marks of existence. Illuminating insight arose within me with regards to things never heard before. Now, I have to stop there, because it's not all that important to this group, but the Buddha's teaching is often presented as a path that was always here, and the Buddha simply tripped over it and started teaching it. I'm using slightly sarcastic words maybe, but to make the point. If we understand what the Buddha taught through the Sutta Pitaka, he's saying this is something that nobody's ever heard before with regards to things never known before. Then I had the thought, what is the condition that the cessation of stress and aging and death is dependent on? From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From the cessation of birth, and in parentheses, this is part of the sutta, but it fits, it keeps it in context. From the cessation of the birth of ignorance as a requisite condition comes the cessation of the stress of aging and death. Again, he's speaking also from the macrocosmic view, but also to the microcosmic view, how we continue from being stuck in this feedback loop to continue to become further ignorant. But from the cessation of that ignorance comes that calm and peaceful mind. From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From the cessation of consciousness, meaning thinking rooted in ignorance, as the requisite condition, comes the cessation of name and form. So we can go at this one of two ways. We can change our thinking, or we can change our thinking. We can change our thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths by gaining understanding of Four Noble Truths, or we can stop self-identifying with wrong views, which is essentially the same thing. But again, we get caught up in that feedback loop of wrong thinking and leading to clinging to self-referential views. Excuse me. I know you've heard me said that if you can unlink any chain of the 12-link chain of dependencies, dependent origination, the whole thing falls apart. That's why it's a good metaphor to call it a chain. So in other words, if you completely abandon craving through understanding, you don't have to go through the process of undoing each one of the links. The whole thing falls apart. If you recognize and interrupt the ongoing process of becoming further ignorant between 7 and 8 or 8 and 9, the whole chain falls apart. You cease becoming. And that's what the Buddha is referring to here. The Eightfold Path is a specific path. It takes time for most of us to develop it. But when you come down to it, it's simply recognizing and abandoning wrong views rooted in ignorance. And we don't have to figure it out. We have instructions on how to do it. It's called an Eightfold Path. All that we need to do to end wrong views is to continue to integrate and develop the Eightfold Path. From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From the cessation of name and form as a requisite condition comes the cessation of consciousness, ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance. And so I have attained the following path to awakening. He's describing it, what he did, and he's teaching us to do the same thing. From the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of consciousness. Recognize and abandon self-referential views. From the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. Recognize and abandon wrong views in ignorant that are ignorant of Four Noble Truths. From the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of the sixth sense base. Now, of course, the Buddha is not teaching that when we awaken, we no longer utilize our senses. He did. But we no longer utilize our senses rooted in ignorance to continue to keep us rooted in ignorance, to continue to reaffirm ignorance. They're simply a reference point of a mind united in this body with life as life occurs, creating no more disturbance. From the cessation of the sixth sense base comes the cessation of contact. Again, the Buddha's not saying we can no longer have contact with the world. That contact no longer reinforces ignorant views. It's all the Buddha's teaching here. From the cessation of contact comes the cessation of feeling. Again, he's not saying we become unfeeling human beings, but our feelings no longer are used to continue to ignore our own ignorance. The context is so important. From the cessation of feeling comes the cessation of craving. If my mind is no longer agitating, giving rise to a pleasant feeling, an unpleasant feeling, or an ambivalent, a neutral feeling, then there's no craving that will follow from it. And it doesn't mean that I won't enjoy a beautiful sunset or a nice piece of blueberry pie, but I won't need more of either one. I'll simply be present with it, and I'll appreciate it a whole lot more. I won't get into the story about the green flash. Now that I mention it, I probably have to, but just very quickly, I had an experience of an amazing sunset one time in Hawaii, a very rare occurrence. And I went back the next night, sitting on this beautiful beach on the Big Island, looking out at this most amazing sunset, but it wasn't the green flash, and I left disappointed. How ridiculous could that be? Instead of being able to appreciate where I was. And that's just something, it keeps coming back to me. I guess it was one of those profound teachings. How could I be disappointed sitting at a beach? I mean, I don't think it's possible to have a less than magnificent sunset in Hawaii, but I found a way to be disappointed because it wasn't what I wanted. From the cessation of craving comes the cessation of clinging and maintaining. If I'm no longer craving for things, I'll no longer cling to and maintain or hope to maintain that which is impermanent. I'll simply enjoy the green flash or the piece of blueberry pie. I think I have a piece of blueberry pie tonight. From the cessation of clinging and maintaining comes the cessation of becoming, becoming further ignorant. From the cessation of becoming comes the cessation of birth. Now, it is, in a somewhat mystical way, talking about a future physical birth, but that's not important. It's no longer possible for me to give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. Why? Because it's not within me anymore. I've recognized it, and I've emptied myself of ignorance, the Buddha's teaching on emptiness. This is the cessation of the entire mass of stress. Vision arose, understanding arose, discernment arose. By the way, he's just describing dependent origination there. Everybody picked up on that? Vision arose, understanding arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illuminating insight arose within me with regards to things never known before. In this way, this is so important, in this way I saw a timeless path. This is where people start saying, well, this is misunderstanding timelessness as an eternal. The Buddha, he's saying timeless in that it transcends time. And we know that it's just as appropriate today as it was 2,600 years ago. It's timeless. It doesn't mean that there was something before. It simply means that now I've discovered something that's never been heard before. And as an awakened human being, I'm saying that it is timeless. It's always appropriate. It's noble. There was actually a long article on Tricycle that I had to respond to. A very famous modern teacher was saying, you know, the Four Noble Truths are useful for some people, but, you know, if they don't resonate with you, you don't need it. There's other things you can do. Okay, but you're missing out on a timeless path. A timeless path to be traveled by the rightly self-awakened ones. And what is this timeless path traveled by the rightly self-awakened ones? The Buddha's referring to himself now, rightly self-awakened one. Just this noble eightfold path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. This is the timeless path traveled by the rightly self-awakened ones. I followed this path. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of stress, of the stress of aging and death, direct knowledge of the origination of the stress of aging and death, direct knowledge of the cessation of the stress of aging and death, direct knowledge leading to the path, direct knowledge of the path leading to the cessation of all manner of stress. I followed that path. Following the path, I came to direct knowledge of birth, of becoming, of clinging, of craving, of feeling, of contact, of the sixth sense base, of name and form, of consciousness, direct knowledge of the origination of consciousness. Remember, thinking rooted in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. Direct knowledge of the origination of consciousness, direct knowledge of the cessation of that consciousness, direct knowledge of the path leading to the cessation of consciousness. I followed that path. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of fabrications, direct knowledge of the origination of fabrications. Fabrications, we had a good, the Anuradha Sutta. Is that it? Maybe not. Fabrications are perversions of reality. It's making assumptions rooted in views that have no true relation to the true nature of human life. They're fabricated. They're not based in any reality. Direct knowledge of the origination of fabrications, direct knowledge of the cessation of fabrications, direct knowledge of the Eightfold Path leading to the cessation of fabrications. He's also saying that when you do it, when you bring fabrications to cessation, you know it. You'll have direct knowledge of it. Excuse me, I promise I'll eat something before the next class. Knowing this directly, I have revealed it to monks, nuns, male lay followers, and female lay followers, so that this undefiled life has become powerful, rich, well-detailed, well-populated, widespread, and proclaimed among many beings. Isn't that remarkable? The simplicity, well, maybe not entirely simple, but the directness and the profound nature of the Buddha describing his awakening. I think that this should be the requisite sutta for anyone who first undertakes Buddhist practice. It was many, many years before I actually came across it in the Sutta Pitaka. And it was as stunning then as I think it is now. It's just remarkable.
It takes quite a bit to unravel it.
Yeah, well,
if you hit it for the first time,
you wouldn't have the proper context to see it. I guess if I read this first, you probably wouldn't, unless someone, hopefully I presented it in a way that it made sense to all of you. I think it has. Mm-hmm. Erica, because you haven't been to a lot of classes, does it suit to make useful sense to you?
Yeah, it makes sense to me. I just kind of fell off of it a little bit, so I'm just getting back into the groove a little
bit. Yeah, that's all right. But the other thing that's remarkable about this is just that it's a human being describing what he did to awaken and why he teaches what he teaches. And so
this is the only place in the Sutta Pitaka where he actually gives this description?
In this detail. You remember in the Loka Sutta he talks a little bit about his awakening experience, and even the Bhava Sutta. The Mula Sutta not so much. Those are the three suttas that I grouped together to describe what becoming means in that context. Mm-hmm. But I've never come across a more detailed... Well, when you read the Paticca-samuppada Sutta, the Sutta on Dependent Origination, he kind of describes this too. This is what I recognize. But not... I don't think I've come across anywhere where he describes that feedback loop and puts it in that way. That
right. And ties into his own experience.
To his own experience. And you would think this is... to me, it's such an important sutta. You're right. It would be hard to read this first, but in context, you really can't do without it. So, any questions about the sutta? And we'll go around the room.
Not a question, but a comment. I think we just have to get in the swim. I mean, I remember when I started. If I walked away with one nugget, that was a learning nugget,
yeah.
Right? And then you're on your way to getting on the path.
Yeah.
So I think you just have to start somewhere. Like, I don't think we can pick, where to start. And this is a lot. I mean, things in here, as we often say. Everything's in here, but if you were new to this and you walked away with one or two things, then that's great. That's good.
Yeah, I don't think. Yeah, you couldn't. I don't think there's one sutta that just off the street you could understand it. But on the website I've listed I think 7 or 8 suttas, beginning with the Nagara Sutta. I think the next one is Dhammacakka, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in that way, learning those in context is a really good foundation. That's why we have the retreats the way we are, to build that strong foundation in that context. And that's really what's necessary. And then, like we had that conversation on the way back, and then nobody can integrate this all at once. I've been doing this for 30 some odd years. It takes a while to integrate all this understanding, but we've all had experience, and I would bet you too, Eric, that something happens and you just say, oh yeah, that's how this fits into my life. This I'm getting a glimpse of reality. We've all had that experience, right? I mean, yes,
right.
No?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's also the way you teach it. To hear this a year ago, and then to have all the building blocks of mindfulness suttas and put it in context to just what we just went through with restraint.
Yeah.
And then to hear it now, you can jump back into it and understand it so much clearer. So it is like a swirl of, the next time it comes around, it's entirely different, but you're different in experiencing it.
Yeah.
So even though it's a lot because it's a bit of a word puzzle, he's saying the whole path.
Yeah. So you find it much more meaningful and useful now, but if you hadn't had your exposure to it, you probably heard this 2 or 3 times now?
The first time I think I even contacted you. I was more interested about this path that was always there. You know, just because I've kind of had, you know, an understanding and question about it. You've set me straight. And, you know, so that's what I had back then. But then everything since, you know, it's entirely different.
So it started, it kind of pointed you in the right direction.
Yeah. And certainly the mindfulness suited. Because how many times does he say it in this?
Yeah. Yeah.
About mindfulness.
Yeah. I want to go with Frank. I'll give you a chance to talk. I know you got to go.
Yeah, he gets up at 3 o'clock. And I keep trying to cut out on everybody. But.
No, I understand. I'm glad you guys make it. So.
Yeah.
But do you have anything else to add before you?
No, I just appreciate the teaching because I think I live my life in that feedback loop. And it's like I feel like I have a lot of stuff to work with in that feedback loop thing, like through my sixth sense base and contact and feelings arise, and I'm really aware of a lot of things, and it's in those points of contacts and feeling and aversion and like clinging, moving towards or away from things.
Yeah.
And and I think I've lived my life in that zone, a large part of it. Wanting things to be different than what they are. You know, when I get the good stuff, I don't get enough of the good stuff.
Yep.
And I want to know when the good stuff is coming back, or how I keep the good stuff. And
well, what a description of craving and clinging.
It doesn't ever work out that way.
Yeah.
And so, I think to know your own suffering, the first noble truth, and the origin of it, like only you can know that. So
yep.
Like that is a really profound teaching to me. And I think I came in here on the Truth of Happiness course, and it was on right speech. And I had a real problem with right speech. I did. And I still sometimes struggle with it. And like I think you told me, first practice right speech with yourself. Be
yep.
gentle with yourself.
Most important.
And so that really showed me where I was really struggling with myself. And then like self-acceptance and just the way that I used to self-talk. And then and how I used to talk to other people. It was such an awareness for me.
Yeah.
And then how do I put a cap, like how do I put a lid on that? I feel like a pressure cooker. So where was all that coming from? You know, and that was the meat and potatoes of all my meditations from December of 2015 to now. You know, it's like every day sitting in meditation, being with that stuff, just kind of like sifting through all that. It's like thumbs up.
Isn't that remarkable? Yeah, and it's those virtuous factors are there, not so we become more virtuous, so we recognize the nature of our own ignorance.
Being able
we
to let go
see
of
it.
All that stuff
right.
Yeah.
Has been incredible. Being able to just like empty myself of ignorance.
Yep.
It's been good.
That's it. Thank you. Yeah. Eric, you have anything you'd like to add tonight? Again, you don't have to, but we'd love to hear what you have to say.
I mean, not really. I'm still just like getting back into it.
Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad you made it. And like your dad just said, like you always be gentle with yourself. You know, if you're just starting your meditation practice back up again, short periods of time are much more important if they're consistent rather than 20 or 30 minutes once a week. So always be gentle with yourself. And it's great to see you here every week.
Thank you.
Get home safe, you guys.
I left 2 cakes out there for you, Bonnie. I split last week and I took them with me.
You left them for Bonnie.
Well, I share them if you want.
And if you want. Thank you, Frank. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you so much.
See you guys. See you guys next week. All right, let's go around the room. We'll start with my friend Ron. You want? You need? Do you want to get out?
No, she wants to get to the pound
cakes
in there.
Oh, we could. Let's just go eat. I'm craving now.
I noticed that you're changing from chocolate cake to blueberry pie.
Right, the influence of
profound changes going on.
Yeah, mild Duca there, a little disappointment, but
Yeah, I was listening to what Dave was saying about, you know, hearing again, and I kind of remember hearing this super the first time, and what a struggle it was to stay with it and not drift off, and because there's so much going. He goes through pretty much everything
in
one super. But now it's like I have more of a perspective.
Yeah.
I can actually encompass in one view a whole bunch of this and have it make sense tied together. I'll probably have to hear it another 5 times, you know, before everything clicks together in one big thing. But I'm actually, again, starting to look forward to the retreat.
You hear it again in a couple of weeks?
Yeah, that's kind of what happens there.
Yeah.
All the things that were a struggle before are less of a struggle, and it's easier to see the big picture. It's nice to be there.
It is, and this is just the nature of the Dhamma. You know, you need to hear. Most people need to hear it over and over again. We read about Sariputta and Moggallana; they only had to hear it once. But most of us, you know, have to have it reinforced. But then it things just fall into place. You know? The same for me with this sutta. You know, it's just. I mean, you can see I get excited just teaching it. You know, and every time I teach it, it just. I don't even know the right words to describe what it's like to teach something that is this profound, and to teach it to people that are actually using it. You know, that's the other thing. I'm very fortunate, Lorna. Good to see you tonight.
Thank you. When I was preparing for the class tonight, I read what you put on your. Your email, you know, your link, and I read it through. And kind of within 2 sections, like your beginning, your introduction.
Yeah.
And then it went on to the actual sutta.
Yeah.
And I read the beginning, was just fascinated by the beginning. And then I kind of ran out of time, something broke my reading off. So when I came back to it, I then read the sutta. So it was in 2 sort of sections. Which was very good, because just like Ram was saying, that there's so much in it. You almost can't just start at the top and go all the way through it and really absorb it all. So I was fortunate that I kind of did it in 2 sections. I have been aware, started, but I can now follow my thinking, that when I am reflecting and confirming who I am by my thoughts, and it's usually when something kind of just happens in the moment that I have the thought of liking it and disliking it, and having that awareness of I am confirming who I am right now. But your introduction today, you mentioned, not quite in these words, I'm sure, but that we all kind of have a typical string of thoughts that we identify ourselves with. And I know I have mine.
Yeah.
And really, if I haven't learned anything tonight, or identified something tonight, it's that I think I'll be more aware of when I'm in my string of thoughts and occupying my mind with my stuff to justify who I am, or who I want to be, or who I want to perceive that I am, or whatever. And I think I have a more understanding of that string of thoughts, which is almost 24/7, it goes on half when you sleep, you know.
Yeah.
also I also thought about just the quick phrase of don't take life personally, that kind of covers so much about what you've talked about tonight.
Yeah.
And then another sutta that you haven't done for quite a while, when you mentioned that only what is seen is seen, only what is heard is heard. In other words, it doesn't reflect back onto who you are. You just hear it. It just stops there. Your mind doesn't go on. You just hear it. You just see it. All three, five physical senses.
That's the Pahiya Sutta.
And then, can I ask a question? I know it's getting late, but this is about last Saturday's class. And we were with the tortoise and the wolves, or whatever it was. The tortoise and the...
Yep, tortoise and the jackal.
Jackal, right. And I sort of got onto the impermanence from that. And noting the arising and passing away through that sutta. This is probably overthinking it. You can overthink all this stuff, and this is probably overthinking it and getting down, going down the wrong path. But is it that the when you have an arising at that point, you also start the passing away, and the passing, and when you go from the passing away is also the start of the next arising. So, and it's that helps keep your mind on a level plane, because you understand that an arising also is the start of the passing away.
Yeah,
so you didn't.
Fine.
So you didn't. You don't go on the arising because you also understand the arising has impermanence, and the passing away starts at the same point as the arising, and the arising starts at the same point as the passing away.
Yeah, and it's all just being present with what's occurring.
Yeah.
The reason why the breath works so well, and it's what we use, is that in the in-breath is the out-breath. Can't have one without the other. It's inherent in it. And so when you understand it that way, at that microcosmic level, you can also say that as a human body is born, it dies. You know, a harsh way of saying it would be life is a death sentence. But it's true, and in the world, the physical world is the same way, and everything within it. And so it's a profound understanding of impermanence to see things that way, even hard physical objects. You know, the 62 Falcon I used to drive 40 years ago, it was pretty hard, you know. I'm sure it's just a pile of rust now. We can't look at anything that doesn't arise and pass away. And to see it in that profound way, it's not just arising and it's not just passing away. It's arising and passing away, just like our breath, just like the Dhamma.
Everything.
So why take anything personal? Because I can't attach myself, even though I'm still thinking about that 62 Falcon I only had for a week, it's not part of me. Nothing is. Who I was when I walked up the stairs tonight is not part of me. Who I was a moment ago. This physical body is completely different, and the thoughts occupying my head in this moment are completely different. They might be similar, and I might have some memories attached. That's simply a process of the function of a physical body. But with a mind free of any clinging, every moment is a new moment. Every moment is a new birth. So that's profound. Thank you.
Okay.
David, good to see you tonight.
Great teaching. I think I have nothing else to add.
Glad you're here. Mary, good to see you.
Good to be here. So much in this really covers everything. I was driving a lot the last few days, so I really had to listen to all the four, you know, attachments, everything, the four different ways that this was taught, you know, that you taught it, which is very helpful. I do feel like a little bit of sense of awe that this is a noble truth, that these are noble truths, that what's in here is, it means something profoundly to me, to be able to say this is the truth. You know, with right effort, I want to integrate the truth more and more as a part of my life. I think that my practice has been going well, and my life has experienced a lot of peace and calm. Recently, I recognize it. I'm grateful for it. Experience a certain amount of integration, and yet there's so much more to do.
Yeah.
But it's just so right. I don't know how else to say that, but it's the path, it's the right direction. It's very noble. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, recognizing a truth is profound. We were talking earlier, there's not much that's really true. When you see the truth, it's a pretty profound experience. Thank you. Bonnie, so good to see you tonight. How are you?
I'm a little tired, but so listening, it's overwhelming in some ways,
yeah,
because it is a lot. So when you end up saying, oh, it's so simple, not from back here. I think, but what Mary was talking about, like to integrate these ideas into my life has been, you know, so useful, and to use Mary's word, profound, in that, so when I listen to things, I have a hard time, like, with my concentration, so it's like I hear one thing, or I hear the things that are important. It's often the things that are really important that, like, wait, can you read? What did you just say? Because there's something about that in which, I can't remember the word you were using, but instead it's sort of like not seeing what it is, right? That the ignorance keeps us from seeing what we need to see. So anyway, I don't want to babble for a long time, but I feel like I'm at a point where I've sort of walked the nautical kind of like the Nautilus, like walking around and integrating, and I'm at a point where I'm not sure if I'm at a plateau because I've gotten there. I've recently had some ability to, for really skillful view, or I'm at a new place in a level where I'm seeing something new. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if you get to a plateau, you can kind of see off. So that doesn't mean that. So using the breath and to cut some of the chains, because just recently I had an opportunity to behave in a certain way or see some things that I feel like it is really, it's old stuff and really connected to things that I have to look, but to be able to look at it when it arises and have a choice about how I speak about it and what my effort is. So I feel like I'm at I don't have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because some of the things and lessons that have happened and occurred and come to me teach me that old way of thinking, really, I don't have to keep it, and I can let it go. But it's hard to let go when the muscle memory says to hold. So despite me being confused about and being able to hear it all at once,
it's a lot. Thank you. I remember when I used to have these plateau experiences, it used to be kind of disturbing because it felt like nothing's going on, you know, not going anywhere. Until I realized that there was these plateau experiences when I was actually integrating what I had learned up until that point. But until I realized that, it can be unsettling.
You know? But then it gives you, I feel like, you know, you climb up somewhere and you get to look at, so I've been given this ability just for a second, you know, to witness what the view is, and then I have a choice about where do I want to walk towards now.
Yeah, you realize that you're seeing things differently.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, it's kind of like stuff I know, but it's at a different level.
Yeah. Different view.
Yeah. A more skillful view, hopefully.
Sounds like it. Thank you, Bonnie. Mm-hmm. Liz, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good to see you. It's good to be here. Remember the first time this sutta really sank in on a retreat and how helpful it is to know that you can interrupt the link at any point. You can interrupt the feedback loop at any point.
Yeah.
So it was good to hear that again.
It is, isn't it? Thank you. Just a few announcements. We are going to continue to collect money for the sign at RLC until Labor Day. So I guess Labor Day's Monday, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I guess tonight and Saturday will be, and all of you have been very generous, but if you feel like continuing to contribute, I'm sure Mary Beth and the folks down there will put it to good use. Well, they'll buy a sign with it. And our retreat is a month away. Less than a month away. There's something else, but I can't think of it.
The
Donna dinner is going to be Tuesday of Thanksgiving week.
And it's at
Love and Oven. There'll be some more details shortly, but you know, the same, use some volunteers. I think Pete Ryan and some of the students from the Lotus School are going to be involved again this year. We'll probably ask for a donation to help just offset some of the costs for Julie at Love
mm-hmm.
and Oven, too. Coming up too, boy, quick. Summer's over, isn't it? Well, summer will be over on retreat, but Labor Day is usually the day when we see that. That's all. We'll finish with metta as we always do. So again, find your relaxed meditation posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth and take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.